Hello, welcome to the first edition of Ohio Global Reports under the auspices of the Center for International Studies of Ohio University, where we talk about the research interests of our faculty and visiting, you know, scholars and, you know, the stakeholders with the and the Center for International Studies. And with me in the studio to do the maiden discussion today, I'm honored to have with me here Professor Francis Nyamjo, is a lecturer at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Professor Nyamjo has been like a friend of Ohio University African Studies and Center for International Studies, and I would let you tell us about yourself and introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yes, thanks very much, Kingsley. As you say, I'm from the University of Cape Town, which I joined in 2009 from Cordesria, where I'd served for 6 years as head of publications. Cordesria, if your listeners don't know, is the Council for the Development of Social Science Research in Africa, which is based in Dakar. I am a friend of Ohio. I was surprised in March 2013 when I received a letter, I think from you, that I had been nominated or voted the African Hero of the Year.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the... I checked it wasn't April, first April, so it wasn't an April Fool. But I came and I discovered the university, and it's a very pleasant place, and that's why I'm here visiting again.
Okay. I also remember that was by the African Students Union. That was when we voted for you as the African Hero, you know, based on the works that you're doing, which are definitely impacting positively on Africa and Africans in general. So we are glad to have you back here again.
Thank you.
We would like to talk about, you know, your research interest. Like I said earlier, I know you do academic works on anthropology, you know, identity and media, globalization, culture. I mean, you're like, you're an authority on so many areas. Would you share with us a little insight into what you do?
I wouldn't call myself an authority, but a very, how would I say, enthusiastic foot soldier who gets into every mission that is dangled in front of him. He finds it interesting to look into. His curiosity is alert. So I'm a very curious being, and this curiosity means that I dabble into lots of things that appeal to me, and I am a social scientist with an eclectic background, as you might call. I call myself a frontier scholar in the sense that I comb the boundaries or the frontiers of different disciplines and try to encourage interdisciplinary conversations. Mm-hmm. I do not feel comfortable being firmly in the heartland of any discipline. Mm-hmm. And because I feel that the real excitement is at the frontiers, is at the borderland. That's where you are most likely to find crossings, mm-hmm. legitimated and illegal crossings, documented and undocumented crossings of disciplines. And then that's a very fruitful, fertile space for me to mm-hmm. contemplate the world from.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would want us to talk about, you know, Africa's media, you know, and you corrected me by when I used the authority, but, you know, most of your works, you know, speak volumes about the evolution of media in Africa, you know, how the media has been appropriated on the continent over the years, you know, since its inception in the colonial days, and what, you know, the phases that it's gone through to date. You know, do you mind sharing with us, you know, how you see the evolution of media across the continent?
Yes. When I started studying media in Africa and especially broadcasting, the tendency in those days were to to shape the media informed by expectations of modernity, and the such expectations were of a very lineal idea of what it meant to be modern. And in many ways, the West was often the former colonial master of a given country was taken as a template. If you go and read into the histories of setting up of broadcast media, radio stations and television stations in Africa, they were almost in the image of the BBC. Mm-hmm. You have every country would call NBC, Nigerian Broadcasting Authority, ZBC, Zambia Broadcasting Authority, and so on and so forth.
And Ghana Broadcasting.
Yes. So the Anglophone countries mimicked the BBC, mm-hmm. And the Francophone countries mimicked France. And there was very little creativity and innovation involved, even as these were claimed as institutions that would be useful to the for national development and cultural development and so on. Mm-hmm. So it was a very problematic approach to development, because it was development as mimicry. And mimicry actually means that you put a pause or on pause on every other thing that you that reminds one of you as a creative human being, and then you simply follow almost like a zombie the acts of those who inspire a particular variant of civilization. But things have changed, and with the proliferation of possibilities thanks to developments like information and communication technologies, new information and communication technologies, people are able to make up for the silences that were very present under the national media institutions, the conventional idea of a radio station, a television station, or a newspaper. People are now able to experiment more, to improvise more, and just to start their own thing and bungle along as they see fit. Mm. But still, within the idea of training of media professionals, and making journalists, producing journalists, the transformation is not as much as one would like to see. I've described it in some of my writings as a full-fledged human being being forced to wear the outfit of a Barbie doll. Exactly the same size, exactly the same design. And when you tell those who are trying to sell you this Barbie doll outfit that you are much bigger, and that you eat your McDonald's sumptuously, you eat your Burger King shop sumptuously, they will tell you, no, you must. This is the only dress in town. You either fit into it or you perish forever. And I think that degree, that model of force feeding contexts without being sensitive to the demands of those contexts is rather too prescriptive. Mm. And so I have said that there's a clear case to be made for African media or African journalism to be enriched by inserting it more firmly within the context of the cultural context and the challenges of being African and being part of the world.
Great. You mentioned the new developments in communication technologies on the continent, and in one of your papers, I think the Village Bell, where you talk about you actually made a profound statement where you said that it looks like African youth are becoming victims of Western imperialism and consumerism. I find that statement that's, very deep, because we all look at the positive sides of these you know, developments, ICTs across the continent. It's giving people voices. It's creating employment, you know. But here you are seeing it with a different critical lens, you know, like with this particular statement that, you know, almost the youth like Sue, your daughter, and, you know, her friends, you know, people who are constantly on the internet, Facebook, and who are being described as victims of Western imperialism and consumerism. Could you shed a little more light on that?
Yes. I didn't quite make the point in that manner. I said there is a case to be made that one could consider the way Africans embrace these technologies as almost passive consumers of what is already perfected elsewhere, or what is already produced elsewhere, unquestioningly embracing rather than adapting it to suit their own needs. I said a case could be made.
A case could be made. Okay.
But at the same time, there's also a case for people, especially the young as well, who embrace these things not as what I would call a zero-sum game, not as an either-or, not as a winner-takes-all. They embrace and they can identify with all the icons and the celebrities and the like that proliferate these new platforms, these social media platforms. But at the same time, that does not foreclose the possibility of them reaching out to African villages and the backgrounds and drawing inspiration from those traditions that are not as represented within these media as would one would expect. So if you look at how Africans relate to the content, there is, of course, a dominant content, which is Western. But at the same time, look at the African presence, say, on YouTube. I'm fascinated by that. During my teaching here, I've pointed students to the possibility that a whole course could be developed on Africa representing itself on YouTube. And you'd have a course for two semesters on that. And they come in not in a very passive way. They come in with all the creativity, and you just need to look at it. Sample YouTube if you have a fast internet connection, and you'll be amazed by the Africa presence on their own terms. So in a way, I think that what African consumers are doing is living a very intricate interconnected situation where they are both victims and not victims, in the way that they because you cannot avoid being a victim in a world that is overwhelmed by this by the sheer power of consumer forces that literally leave no room to differ.
I really like that you mentioned YouTube, you know, in particular, and, you know, new media in general. And we've talked about this, you know, how Africa has been represented in the Western media over the years, you know. But usually the discourse only ends there. You know, people only talk about how Africa has been either misrepresented or underrepresented in the Western media without, you know, recourse or without even looking at the role of African media itself. And then another, you know, a new variable which has also been added to that particular conversation is the role of new media in Africans telling their own stories. And you just mentioned that of you know, YouTube. Are there other ways that you could talk about how you know, new media is providing itself as a platform for counter narrative?
First of all, I would like to say that the West does not have the monopoly of misrepresenting Africa. Because Africans can excel at misrepresenting themselves, especially if they have bought into the logic of the zero-sum game, the logic of a certain modernity that you're expected to aspire to, but which basically means to qualify, you have to sacrifice every other thing that is not that. So misrepresentation in this case is not the monopoly of the West. But clearly within African settings, you also have people who are now using these opportunities to make a difference, to tell a different story of Africa. You've read Chimamanda Adichie's TED, or watch her TED talk about the problematic nature of the dangers of a single story. And lots of people have said that, only she's the latest to say it, but it still catches on as something which is problematic. And so Africans, I think, today have the greater possibilities, not of telling a counter story, but of telling complementary stories of themselves, such that you have a plurality of stories and accounts of what the continent is all about. You do not have reductionist accounts only, but you have myriad possibilities in circulation.
Let's now shift the focus to education. You know, and I've read, you know, potted plants in greenhouses, and this, you know, this talk about, you know, the educational structure of Africa, you know, how Africans are being educated, how, you know, our schools are being, you know, what goes into the educational organization of Africa. Is it colonial? You know, is it modern? What's happening on the continent in terms of education?
Yes, I think the colonial model of education, which has been seriously criticized by authors such as Okot Bitek in Song of Lawino, it has been criticized indirectly by writers such as Amos Tutuola in The Palm Wine Drinkard and his other novels. Says, I can tell the story I want, the way I want, and without asking whether or not I speak English the way you want. So these have been criticized. It is still very resilient on the continent. And it's resilient because I think it is a structure that offers possibilities, some sort of capital, cultural capital, to an elite few who can then use it to acquire positions and to navigate the world in frequent flyer possibilities like myself. So I and other elite have a vested interest in keeping the colonial education going as potted plants in greenhouses. And because it means that it reduces the number of people who are exposed to possibilities internationally. Every time a parent sends their child to an Ivy League school in Africa or abroad, they say they want them to be competitive internationally. So in a way, we seek recognition to the detriment of relevance to the local context through such systems of education. And I think you can have comparisons with American societies. I read a book recently called Too Much Schooling, Too Little Education, and also Waiting for Superman, a documentary about education and aspiring for elite and Ivy League education in America, and how challenging and frustrating the whole process is. So it seems like education is so elitist that actually it ends up producing just potted plants in greenhouses with very little relevance to the wider society. The question then becomes, is there no case to be made to have more popular and popularized notions of education informed by the predicaments of the wider society, and also informed by popular understandings of what it means to know and to be knowledgeable? Popular epistemologies, I call them. Rather than this phoniness that we call science, which means basically weeding everyone else until you have only a few standing and claiming entitlement. So.
I mean, that's a very important point, you know, because we all know the value of education, you know, obviously to the whole continent. But and I was educated on the continent, you know, right from primary school, you know, right from when you were a kid, you go to, you know, these schools and they are written boldly, you know, on the school walls, do not speak vernacular, you know, vernacular, which is your local language. And some will write, speak English. Mm. You know, I recall instances where if you were in class and, you know, the absence of a teacher, if you talked in class or if you spoke, because they all wanted us to be quiet. So if you talk or if you spoke, you know, we had the class captain who had been taxed with writing the names of talkatives in class in the absence of the teacher. Now, the interesting thing is that if you spoke, you know, the same words with someone who spoke English and you spoke vernacular, they write DP by your name. And I got lots of DPs, which is double punishment, you know, for speaking your own language. So, you know, this thing, you know, sinks in our head and we grow with it, you know, hating our own language. Do you think, and you are an educator, obviously, in higher circles of education on the continent, what is the solution?
Yeah, I mean, as we say, colonial education was all about a civilizing mission. And civilization presupposed that you were primitive, you were barbarian, and you needed to be purged of your savagery. But increasingly, we have realized that that civilization was if you wanted to insist, civilized savagery. It wasn't an absence of savagery, it was just another form of savagery. And now that's why students are demonstrating in universities, and the latest being in South Africa, calling for colonial symbols to be brought down. And one of them was at the University of Cape Town, where the statue of Cecil John Rhodes, the British capitalist who enriched himself in Southern Africa to the detriment of the local populations, and of course set a very firmly colonial idea of what it meant to be human. They're challenging that these days. They're asking for curricula to be revisited, and they're asking for a much more level playing field. They're asking for greater representations in universities where they're purported to be educated, asking for greater black presence in South African universities post-apartheid. So it seems like we, the older generation, might have denounced Amos Tutuola and denounced all of this because we wanted to maintain our elite privileges. But now the chicks are coming home to roost, and our children are asking us very critical questions we cannot answer, and literally ordering us to step aside if we cannot stand the heat of transformation.
That's very refreshing to know. Yeah. And I know, you know, some of these things are really contagious. You know, they happen on one side of the continent, and before you know, it's also caught on the other parts of the continent. And, you know, so I hope people buy into this idea of challenging the colonial status quo. But you mentioned, you know, level playing field, which I think, you know, leads me to our next question when it comes to, you know, world epistemological, I'm talking about knowledge production. You know, you have most of these so-called accepted knowledge being Western-oriented, you know. So when it comes to knowledge production, do you see an imbalance concerning, you know, the global South and the global North? African, you know, scholars, I know you are writing and other people are also writing, but are they fairly represented on the epistemological table in terms of knowledge production?
No, I think there is a very skewed idea of what constitutes knowledge anywhere in the West as well as in Africa. Mm. I haven't been in the U.S. for long, but at least I do visited a few rural areas. And the rural areas around Athens reminds me so much of the very many places in Africa that I come from. Mm. And no one who comes from a village in Africa and inserts directly in a village here would think that they have missed anything or they have taken a plane before. So it tells you the same logic, the popular ideas of what constitutes knowledge, the idea that life is larger than logic, and you should not reduce it to sensory perceptions alone. The idea that there are cosmological factors as well as physical factors that inform our understanding of what is the world. They are spread all over and they are shared by popularly across the world, including the West. So what we call the Western is actually a very narrow, streamlined version of what should constitute knowledge and what should amount to knowledge production, legitimate knowledge production. And that is exported on behalf of the entire West to other parts of the world. And then who don't know any better, and then they see it as if it was shared by the entire West and as if everybody was agreed upon it as the way forward. So my point, why I make that point, is to come to another to the point I've made repeatedly about knowing and producing knowledge in Africa, is that there is a compelling reason to reintegrate that narrow elitist ideas of what it means to know with popular understandings of the world and reality around them. And what it, for example, I started this conversation by referring to myself as a frontier scholar. But the very idea of being at the frontiers means collapsing dichotomies and binaries and so on. So there are often certain binaries between scientific knowledge and non-scientific knowledge. A more productive way forward would be to collapse that binary and to look for just how different ways of knowing, scientific and otherwise, complement each other, one another, for the best interest of members of a given society.
Then do you think that some of the challenges, you know, on the continent in terms of really aid, you know, in terms of knowledge production from coming from the continent, you know, you talk about, you know, lack of, I know we've come a long way though, but there are still some challenges.
No, there are challenges. There are, of course, the political economy of placing what you've produced on the global marketplace of ideas. The fact that those who have greater power and greater means control the access, and who qualifies, the peer review system, the positioning of journals and the publishing houses, the idea that people can judge a book just from its cover. If it was published at Harvard or Stanford or Yale, it passes all tests, and your peers are no longer sitting in judgment over your book because it's been published in these places. They take it for granted that the content must be good. And if it's published, say, in Cameroon or published in Ghana, however rich the content is, you're likely to perish, to publish and perish because of your geography. So these things need to be reconsidered, and we should actually not sacrifice important grounded scholarship for superficialities, for appearances. And again, that's because of the system of knowledge that privileges the appearances. It is appearances that sensory perceptions, what your senses bring home to you, might actually be very deceptive. Imagine when you are a student at Ohio University and you are drunk and you see things. The next morning when you think it clears up, you are not quite certain what you saw. So to see is not necessarily evidence of something being there.
It's very, you know, good that you talked about, you know, these issues. But that brings to mind, you know, initiatives on the continent, especially like Langa, you know, Research and Publication Center. You know, these are initiatives by people like yourself and, you know, like-minded, you know, scholars on the continent who are also helping, you know, in the knowledge, you know, production field. Could you tell us a little bit about Langa Production?
I left, before I come to Langa, very briefly, I left University of Botswana and went to work with Cordesria because I believed in the alternative or at least serious possibilities Cordesia was offering in terms of knowledge production and publications to bring to present Africa in a more positive light. Knowledge generated by African scholars struggling on the continent to get by, but still able to produce something that is well thought through by themselves. And within Cordesia, I also realized that the funding that came was not enough to be able to do justice to the whole volume of material that was out there.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, when I left Cordesia, or even when I was in Cordesia, I became part of a group of scholars who created an institute called Langa Research and Publishing Outfit to make a difference from nothing, but just by sheer form of sheer commitment and voluntary service. And I think we have done something to be proud of. We have over 400 books out there competing with the well-established Ivy League publishers of the world. But still, it's a very important statement that Africa does not have to wait until somebody comes with aid before they can start living their dreams. Yeah.
Obviously, that's a very important. And then I would want us to touch briefly on another area that you work on, which is the issue of identity. You know, and then that's also closely linked to the issue of Africanity. You know, who I noticed you raised some of these questions in some of your papers. Who is an African? Is it, you know, an American who studies Africa? Is it an American student who is committed to the ideas? Or is it somebody who was born on the continent with his novel cut and buried somewhere in an African hospital? What is the idea of African identity?
I would even ask it much higher up. What is the idea of being a human being in a world? Do we define a human being in abstraction? Or do we define a human being within a context of particular relationships and interconnections that make them fulfill themselves or therefore fulfill their humanity? I feel that descriptions in abstraction are useful to some extent, but are not very meaningful, because only in interactions do you see the full possibilities and limitations of claiming an identity, whether claiming to be human or claiming to be African. In class yesterday, I joked with students when I said this. They all complained that Africa is overexploited. And I said, in many regards, not everybody qualifies to be exploited. There are some people who are desperate, dying to be exploited. They swim across the Mediterranean wanting to be exploited, but nobody is interested in exploiting them. So you see that if you had to have a hierarchy of humanity, then you could imagine those who qualify to be exploited, and they're very happy. Because they may not be exploiters, but they are very happy that they have reached the threshold of being exploited. And those who are beneath the radar, because they don't quite qualify. They don't qualify to be zombies. So I do play around with the ideas of identities, how they are articulated in abstraction, and how they take on whole new meanings within particular contexts and given a set of relationships of power, relationships of exposure or access to material resources and so on and so forth. I suppose from that you cannot begin to understand what I mean by my idea of an African is. But again, I don't believe in geographical essentialisms or so on and so forth, or cultural essentialism. So being an African for me is somebody who is nimble-footed, sweet-footed, and is able to cross borders. But unfortunately, the reality of being African is when you knock at a border and you are not let in. Then you know you're an African. Whether you are based in Mexico or you are based in Africa, it doesn't matter.
Well, you've been listening to Ohio Global Report, brought to you by Center for International Studies of Ohio University. I've been your host, Kingsley Ntubuisiakon, and it's been an honor having in the studio a renowned professor, Professor Francis Nyamjo from the University of Cape Town. We are actually grateful for your presence here. I was in class, you know, the class that you taught this semester, and on behalf of, you know, my colleagues and, you know, and all of us on campus, we say thank you very much for availing yourselves and your works, you know, because you gave us access to lots of works that you've done. We are grateful to have had you here.
Thank you very much, Kingsley. Yeah. Yeah. Cheers.